The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Hey, John boy, how's the weather?
John Morosi.
JP can provide some clarity as to what went on. JP.
Bob, I will do my best.
Columnist for MLB.com.
Morosi. Where is Jeff Passan in all of this?
Here's John Morosi.
Where is Jeff Passan?
Should we just call Jeff Passan right now?
Yes, just call him.
Fox Sports baseball contributor.
JP Morosi had it first. How you feeling, Padres fans?
MLB Network insider.
So Garrett Crochet, I was told the White Sox are so far away from what they perceive to be their competitive window, that they would prefer to get prospects who have not even debuted yet in the major league.
John Morosi.
I'm so happy, I can't lie to you. It's the best moment of my life. All the fans who are here supporting me, it means the world.
Sources confirm that fun.
On 670 The Score.
We are in the middle of our baseball hour here on Spiegel and Holmes, considering that the hot stove is burning up right now and the biggest free agent signing has happened in Major League Baseball. We were like, we should carve out some time to really get into this, talk about it, and who better to talk about it with than John Morosi. Hey, John, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
I'm doing outstanding. Greetings from Dallas. I am steps away from the lobby here at the winter meeting, so I'm literally bringing you right into the action, my friends.
That's outstanding. Can you tell us what the Cubs are doing? We've heard, John, that they want to trade Bellinger, but they kind of want to replace his money. So is it, what are they doing? What's the organizational plan here from the Cubs' perspective as they're out on Juan Soto and not interested?
What is the Cubs' plan? That is a great question. I'll say this. I do hear a lot about the Cubs being willing slash eager to move some pieces off their major league team, because the main reason is they understand that they've got Owen Casey coming. Of course, they've got PCA establishing himself now in the major leagues. And at some point, they have to clear roster spots for this team to get younger or utilize that young talent, like an Owen Casey, for example, to bring in someone like Garrett Crochet. And I think they're weighing out those options. And if Cubs fans have the perception that they're somewhat stuck between a couple different paths, I think that's a correct description of where they're at right now. It's not as though they don't have a plan. I think they are trying to make different plans work, and that could involve, to your point, maybe trading for someone like a Kyle Tucker and utilizing some of their assets. But even if you did that, you might have to involve a third team. There's a lot of overlapping ideas with where the Cubs are right now. And they are one of those teams that is, I think, a little more difficult to ascertain exactly what their true north and true plan is, because they are involved in a few different and somewhat seeming conflicting ideas of what their plan is right now.
What do you expect Craig Counsell's role, now that he's had a year to see how the organization works, what do you expect his role to be in the framing of the team and not just managing it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think he is someone that you go back to his earliest days when he was with the Brewers. He was in a bit of an evaluating and special assistant role, to where he traveled a lot and saw minor league players. And I thought his very candid assessment at the end of the season about the Cubs being far behind where the Brewers are at the moment was telling and suggests to me that he's really willing to kind of get into some of the more granular aspects of this organization. You saw him, I think, take a very active role in shaping the coaching staff and bringing in the likes of Quinton Berry and others that he knows. I think that was a good step. I also think he's going to have a big voice in what the club looks like in terms of which young players they trust and in which role. I saw Matt Shaw play, for example, at the Premier 12, and I saw him play a very good third base. If he's ready to play third base, and to my eye, it looks like he's really close to doing that, that opens up a lot of different possibilities for an Isak Paredes. And Craig Council's assessment right now of Matt Shaw's readiness, I believe, could potentially open up some additional areas of trades that would allow the Cubs to address other needs they have right now in clear abundance.
You mentioned Kyle Tucker. One more year left on his contract. 27-year-old Houston superstar, really. Three times an all-star, 3 years in a row, an OPS of 993 this past year, although it was injury-plagued. What's the realistic possibility that he becomes a Cub?
Well, I would not describe them as the leaders right now. I think that the Yankees are the team that, again, if the Astros move him, and I'm going to use the word if, because we were down this road a year ago with Alex Bregman, who had 1 year left, and his name was out there. He didn't move anywhere, and he played out his full contract year in Houston. He's a free agent right now. That is certainly a very decent possibility here that Kyle Tucker goes nowhere. But the Astros are looking at the big picture here of the marketplace and seeing that a lot of teams right now are not comfortable at all with the price of free agents. And the Cubs, honestly, might be one of them, where the Cubs could say, listen, we trade Bellinger to a team that really needs him, like, for example, the Yankees, and then utilize either some of their own internal pieces or guys they might bring back in a theoretical trade involving Bellinger to then go and pursue Kyle Tucker. I don't see the Cubs being any more than a 20 to 25% chance at the moment, to be honest with you, to get a Kyle Tucker. But the point is they've got the prospects to be involved in a Garrett Crochet conversation, to be involved theoretically in a Dylan Cease conversation, in almost any conversation they want to have. And I think that's part of the reason why we are hearing that they've at least inquired on Kyle Tucker, because when your farm system is as good as the Cubs is, it allows you to have conversations about virtually any player who's on a near expiring contract. And Kyle Tucker is one of many of them being discussed here in the lobby in Dallas right now.
So Kyle Tucker with 1 year left, Dylan Cease with 1 year left, Vlad Guerrero Jr. with 1 year left. And these are the kind of players that maybe the Cubs are targeting with cost certainty in mind. The Seattle Mariners come up a lot as a pitching arm that the Cubs might go for. Logan Gilbert has a couple years left. Luis Castillo's at $24 million for 3 years, so that seems like a lot. Brian Wu is really cheap. Like who might they target from that batch of Seattle pitchers, if anyone?
Well, you're mentioning a few great names, and I think that there's a reason why we have heard about this potential pairing, because all of them, to varying degrees, make a lot of sense. Because when you consider the Cubs and pitching at Wrigley, this group of pitchers in general has enough stuff, I believe, to succeed in all seasons of a baseball year at Wrigley Field. Wu has been a little more injury prone, so there's a little more volatility there. Gilbert, I think that's the home run of all these options. And I think the Cubs would have to really kick in probably multiple young bats. I mean, to get a Logan Gilbert, I think you'd have to give up some combination of PCA, Casey, Matt Shaw. I mean, you would need to really dip down in at least, I would say, two of the three if you're really serious about getting Logan Gilbert because of how good he is. I actually think, in my estimation, I've got Gilbert as a higher value player than Garrett Crochet, because he's got a better track record of being healthier than Garrett Crochet. And with a very similar amount of service time left. So the Mariners and Cubs are a natural fit because the Mariners need bats and the Cubs have bats at multiple different positions. So the Mariners have arms, which is what the Cubs need. So that possibility has been discussed, explored. I could see Bellinger being a fit there. The Mariners, though, and this is actually to pull it back a little bit, you mentioned the amount of money due on Castillo. if Bellinger is going to Seattle, I would say that Castillo might be the most likely one to go to Chicago because of the comparable salaries due. I think they actually, the salaries work out pretty well if you really look at it, and I think that would be a pretty interesting possibility going forward.
John, what do you make of the idea that there were multiple teams that were willing to go above $700 million for the best player or best offensive player not named Shohei Ohtani? That maybe we've broken through of it just being a Dodger thing and other teams are willing to go the distance to try to bring in players as good as Soto.
Well, I think it's a really important point about where we're at right now as an industry. You're right. There are a handful of teams that were in there on Soto at big dollars, but there are not 8, 9, 10, 11 teams that are going to offer $200 million for Corbin Burns or Max Fried or name your other Alex Bregman. The amount of – it's amazing if you follow all the reporting that we're doing here at the meetings from all the insiders. It's amazing how you look at the list of teams that are on Corbin Burns. What are we saying? Yankees, Red Sox, Giants, maybe the Blue Jays? Who's on Max Fried? Yankees, Red Sox, Blue Jays. Who's on Alex Bregman? Astros, Phillies. It's basically the same six or seven teams. And to be honest, in terms of the really true high dollar free agents, we're not hearing the Cubs on Corbin Burns. We're not hearing them on Max Fried. Now, is it possible that we're all missing it and they end up signing him? I suppose, but it's not terribly likely. And so I think the game right now is very much separated into the teams that are willing to spend, not without any restrictions at all, but really willing to spend huge dollars. And that is the New York teams, Boston to an extent, Toronto, Dodgers, Giants. It's a pretty – Houston, Philly. It's a pretty small list. And that's why everybody else is either trying to get inexpensive talent or in terms of what they're earning, okay, like a Dylan Cease or a Crochet, those types of arms. They're trying to get inexpensive players based on salary, or they're trying to move the large contracts they have, like Bellinger, like, say, a Suzuki, to be able to free up the capital to go out and get players like the aforementioned Crochet and Cease. That's why I think we're seeing a little bit of a stalemate right now, because the number of teams that have big dollars, they're in their own room right now. And the other 23 teams are trying to work on that marginal $1 million here and there, whereas Steve Cohen he's blown way past that. And it's like a two-tiered sport right now. It's like the big the big six and then the other 24.
Interesting. You mentioned Seiya Suzuki. Our Bruce Levine talked to Seiya's agent about this possibility of a list of teams that Seiya might waive his no-trade clause for. Do you think it's possible that Seiya gets moved, and why would it happen if it does?
Well, I do think it's possible because of exactly what we're talking about, that even if the Cubs can't get a team to take on his entire salary, it would be a meaningful savings, and it would potentially allow them to keep Bellinger and still add a reliever. I've seen Jesse Rogers reporting on Kyle Finnegan. I was told that today that they would like to add some late inning bullpen. Obviously, we know they want to add some starting pitching. If you can trade, and let's say a team takes on, let's say a team will at least take 60% of Seiya's money, then you're able to use some of that savings and sign a Walker Buehler or make a play for a Jack Flaherty. So I do think for the right team, Seiya would move that note, would waive his no trade clause. But I think that's one of the significant issues the Cubs are encountering right now is, yeah, they would like to have moved players. And honestly, guys, this was a topic back at the trade deadline. They were willing to move some players, but because of the no trade clause, it was a very challenging thing for them to do. So I do think that moving Seiya is a possibility. It wouldn't surprise me if the Seattle Mariners were again a piece of that conversation because of their need for bats. So I do expect the Cubs to be very active in trade talks, whether it's Bellinger, Seiya, some other names as well.
John, as always, we appreciate your time and your expertise. Thanks so much for joining us.
Very good. I've got my walking shoes on, guys. I'm going to be walking laps around the lobby, and I'll let you know what else I can find out.
All right, we'd love to hear that. That's John Morosi.
He's on it.
It's great stuff from him, explaining kind of how the market has changed. And what's upsetting is that when he talks about the teams that are in the room, the Cubs are not one of the teams that he's talking about. That's bothersome to me. It's so frustrating.
So you said the top six. So he's thinking Yankees, Mets, Dodgers, Giants, who just signed Willie Adames and may not be done, Phillies.
And the Angels?
I don't know.
Because of the money that they're willing to spend, not that they're good.
Or the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays, who were supposed, and the Red Sox.
Desperate.
So that's seven.
The fact the Cubs are not on that list is upsetting. They should be part of that. So I mentioned this before we talked with John. And I'm going to try to be delicate, but I'm also really frustrated with this because this has been the reputation of this guy for a long time. Dansby Swanson had surgery, and it looks like he had a sports hernia, and he had surgery. I don't have a problem with that. Players get hurt all the time. I don't have a problem with him getting surgery because you got to get surgery to get yourself back on the field.
Nico Hoerner also had surgery after the year came to an end.
I don't have a problem with a player needing more time to get himself right. What I do have a problem with is a player trying to play through stuff when it's clearly affecting what they are and then not telling the team. This from Megan Montemurro. She wrote this about the Dansby thing. The circumstances around Swanson's injury are unclear, namely when he sustained the hernia. The Cubs had been unaware he was playing through it, which Swanson revealed to the team after the season ended when he wanted to see a specialist and get it fixed in October. The quote from Jed Hoyer, "We were surprised, candidly," which is fine. That's his personality. He was going to play, but clearly he was feeling something he wanted to get fixed, close quote.
The same thing, or it's not the same thing, but something happened the year before in September where he wouldn't sit down, and the September numbers in 2023 dipped.
I think this is being a bad teammate.
Wow. Wow. What if I told you he had an 856 OPS in September?
What did he have before that?
In August, it was 783. His season turned in late July. It was an absolutely awful July. 578 OPS in July. And a terrible start. 476 in May. A decent June, but whatever. I remember because I was close to the team. It changed in late July, and he started doing it. And so all of August and September was actually really good.
It's your body? But at least let the team know what's going on with you. And if you and the team go, I'm going to try to play through this, fine. But this idea of Dansby Swanson is Mr. Tough Guy and he won't take himself out of the lineup when he's got a real thing that's happening that not only requires him to have surgery, but to go see a specialist. And that he informs the team of that in October, I don't like that at all. That is not being a good teammate.
It's interesting. 160 games played in 21, 162 games played in 22. And when they signed him, the availability and the constancy was a huge part of the appeal. And 147 games in 23, 149 in 2024.
I'm okay with Dansby Swanson playing 140 games at the top of his game. And that's probably what you're going to have to do with him as he gets older because of the demands of his position, which is part of the reason you go, man, they really signed him to a very long-term deal for a position that puts the most stress on a body.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he thinks that playing Mr. Tough Guy is being the good teammate. And I do think that there are instances where that is the case, where you're in a playoff run and you're fighting through something, but you're still the best option for the team.
Don't you think defensively he was the best option for the team all year long?
I do think that he was the best option for the team defensively.
I do, and the ability to just pencil him in and know you've got that shortstop is a big thing that both the managers have talked about.
Yeah, but you need to be transparent. That relationship needs to go both ways. Let Craig Counsell make a call on that. Don't you just assume, well, I'm just Dansby and I just fight through stuff. Tell somebody what's going on. Mm-hmm. My issue is not even him playing through it.
But it's not communicating about it.
Not telling them that something legitimately was going on with you is not good.
I hear that. I absolutely can hear that. The fact that the offensive numbers kicked up and he found it finally in August and September and that the offense was good then makes me really want to know when this happened. Was it something that, because he looked off in all phases for a while there early on. The defense was off. Everything seemed off. The other thing is, like, I know that there was something personal that had gone on that eventually he did talk about, his longtime hitting coach that he had in Atlanta who had passed away from a car accident last year. So, like, that was going on, and people were wondering whether that was going on. So, look, I understand what you're saying, and the lack of communication I agree with you with. I just feel like he did know that that physically as a hitter, he was okay in those last couple of months.
And then immediately had surgery after the season was over.
Mm-hmm.
Just let somebody know. Just let them, because how quickly might you have been able to get back? And because Craig said, look, he should be ready to go at the beginning of spring training. But those are all things that maybe if you had said something to someone, that it gets done earlier. And instead of saying should, we're saying he will be ready for spring training. That's what I'm saying.
I hear you. And overall, it's a bad offensive year. And after just kind of a decent, you know, below average offensive year the year before, this is a bad offensive year for your biggest salaried player
yes.
at this point.
And we all know you're tough. We all know it. We all know that's the reputation. You're Mr. 162. We all get it. But the Cubs need the best version of him. And if he's out there playing through stuff mm-hmm. that requires surgery, you're not getting the best version of him, period.
He's Lawrence Holmes. I'm Matt Spiegel. It is Spiegel and Holmes. You're in the middle of a baseball hour. There's lots of good football stuff coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. But we got another big baseball thing to discuss.
Yeah, a happy one.
Yeah, a really happy one. A really important guy that you need to know the full context of. Chicago's latest Hall of Famer. We need to discuss that next on Spiegel and Holmes on the Score.
Spiegel and Holmes Show Flashback.
Well, with one out, here is Richie Allen. Allen has faced Lindy McDaniel many times in the National League. There's a long drive, deep center, way back, it might be. It could be. Hey, almost into the net. Ball is down. Richie Allen hit one into the center field stand. I almost got it with my net. It hit a fan's hand right in front of me.
Harry Carey.
Shirtless out there in center field with a net in case a home run comes close. Calling the home run from the brand new Hall of Famer. White Sox great and a few other places as well. Dick Allen.
It's so nice to go to his baseball reference page and see the yellow banner Hall of Fame.
That's cool. A lot of people have been wanting this for a long time.
I'm one of them because his numbers say that he's a Hall of Famer. When you end up with a career OPS of 912, usually 850, 860 is about where the Hall of Famers are. When you start talking about OPS and seeing a guy with a 912 OPS and a league MVP and a rookie of the year and a bunch of all-stars not be in the Hall of Fame is ridiculous.
7 All-Star games, Rookie of the Year, MVP. I saw this stat because I agree with you. His OPS plus, a regular OPS plus is 100. That's the baseline. His was 156 among all players in the history of baseball with 7,000 plate appearances. His 156 OPS plus is tied for 14th all time with Frank Thomas. So he and Frank Thomas, identical OPS pluses in their career. And the thing about Dick Allen, call him Dick because that's his name and that's what he wanted to be called his entire life, is that he was a brilliant hitter with tons of slugging consistency in a great pitching era. Like, it included those late 60s and the year of the pitcher, 68, before they lowered the freaking mound because Bob Gibson had a 1.12 and he was in the National League as a member of the Phillies, and Denny McLean won 30 games, all that stuff. And he was truly great. That MVP year of 72, the composite ERA in the American League was 3.47. That was the ERA in the American League, and Dick Allen had the year he had.
Even in the year of the pitcher, his slash was 263, 352, 520. 872 OPS in that season, and a 160 OPS plus that season.
Guys who were great in that era, it's kind of akin to the way I think about Pedro Martinez, who dominated in the steroids era for hitters. If you were a great hitter between like 64 and 74, which was Dick Allen's prime, you were really, truly special. And he was truly special.
And now he gets the opportunity to posthumously go into the Hall of Fame. And I saw the video of his son when the announcement is made. That's beautiful to see that man's lifelong dream of being a Hall of Fame player, he finally gets it. Unfortunately, it happens long after his death, and it boggles the mind when you start thinking about all of the people that left him out of this. I thought Layla made a really great point about the gatekeeping. And I get that the Baseball Writers Association of America is a really important journalistic group, but it's always bothered me that there were people on the electronic side of media that clearly belonged in the voting for Hall of Fame that, because they weren't members, weren't allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like even our own Bruce, like that's, who's seen more baseball in Chicago than Bruce Levine?
Oh, yeah, no, it's crazy. It's crazy that he
Bob
doesn't.
Bob Costas. Sure. You know what I mean? Like, they're real people that are stewards of the game,
mm-hmm,
that didn't have 10 years, which is, that's the rule, that you have to have 10 years of covering the game to be able to vote for the Hall of Fame.
These two guys got in via the Veterans Committee, just a 16-member Hall of Fame board appointed electorate that has some former players like Paul Molitor, Eddie Murray, Lee Smith, and Joe Torre, and then some major league executives and people like that. So this was the smaller Veterans Committee that finally voted in Dick Allen and Dave Parker. But there's certainly, it was Veterans Committee in 2014 as well, when Dick Allen didn't get in, when he was alive and would have really enjoyed this, to your point. There's it's a career of sociological importance. I mean, they called him Richie. His manager in Philly, Gene Mauch, called him Richie, and he didn't want to be called Richie. He's 22 years old. The man's name is Dick, and they decided to call him Richie, which he felt was diminutive. They threw stuff at him.
Threw batteries at him. That's why he had to wear a helmet in the outfield.
His entire career, he wore a batting helmet.
In his home park.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's an important thing to remember here. When you start thinking about Philadelphia and the Philadelphia franchise in the history of the game, they were the last team, the last one to integrate. 10 years after Jackie Robinson.
57.
10 years.
I think the Red Sox might have been even after them. But they were
the National League.
They were the last National League team to integrate. Yeah, those proud Red Sox association.
I think they're the last in all of baseball.
The Red Sox?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it Jim Rice? Was he the...
No, I think it was a guy named Pumpsy Green.
My guy.
Good old Pumpsy. So they were the last team. But you're right. Philly, he was treated terribly. An insanely volatile career in Philly because he was treated bad, and then his behavior, like,
might have reflected that.
100%. It deteriorated, and he pushed back, and it was... But you know what he did the entire time was rake. He raked the entire freaking time that all that stuff was going on, but traded to the Cardinals in a deal for Curt Flood. Yes, that was the famous trade that Curt Flood refused and started that. He was good as a Cardinal, was Dick Allen, pretty good as a Dodger, traded to the White Sox for Tommy John. And then the White Sox,
who was also on the list and didn't make it this time.
Yes. But the White Sox embraced Dick Allen, and he embraced Chicago. He said that Chicago was the first city to really call him Dick, to call him Dick Allen. And he said, I made my mind up right then that Dick Allen was going to pay back Chicago for the respect they were giving me.
Remember how when you were talking about Juan Soto, like the small things mattering to people, that it's that sort of thing where there is a level of respect that is paid to the man that he goes, okay, I can embrace being here. And what does he give you that first season? A season 8.6 war when he wins the MVP. His slash line for the White Sox in 1972, 308, 420, 603.
Uh-huh.
His OPS plus that year was 199.
An outrageous season. His manager, Chuck Tanner, and his former teammate, now the late Bill Melton, talked about Dick Allen's MVP season.
I think by watching Dick Allen through that year, Dick Allen is a leader. But Dick Allen doesn't have to say anything. I think Dick Allen leads by example. We look at his average, 308, 37 home runs. To me, he hit about 390. For a season of 162 games, Dick Allen not only hit in a clutch when it was necessary or stole the base, but even his outs. I mean, he just hit the ball as hard as anybody through a year that I had seen.
Amen. Dick Allen was the leading vote getter in the 72 All-Star game, and he played all season at a near Triple Crown pace.
It could be 110 degrees out, and he had long underwear on and 100% long sleeve shirt that hung down over his wrist, and he took that mammoth log up to the plate with it and wiggled around like it was a toothpick, and he was the Cadillac of the day. He was the man who, at the end of the year, they had to make him the most valuable player in the league because he hit the ball as hard as anybody can, or will, or ever has. And to me, he's extra special. I really believe that Dick Allen saved the Chicago White Sox franchise. He carried us on his back. Nobody did what he did. Nobody contributed like he did to a ball club. And there's no question in my mind, he had the greatest individual year of any player I've ever seen or managed.
You hear that last bit? He saved the franchise. You're like, oh, come on. But that was a team that they had played games in Milwaukee, man. They were talking about leaving. Their attendance was under like 800 grand. And then all of a sudden they had 3 years of over a million with Dick Allen and Melton and Harry Carey broadcasting. They got totally revitalized.
Yeah. So you hear all the, and he was just cool.
Oh, dude.
Like he was just cool. And coolness matters in baseball, or at least it should. And seeing him just be that guy, all you need to do is look up the Sports Illustrated cover. Just look it up.
Yeah.
With Dick Allen on the front of it. And you get that. You get the vibe of it. And I'm so happy because people who have listened to me on The Score over the last few years know that this has been a thing that's been stuck in my craw. The fact that he isn't in the Hall of Fame. And we know that a big portion of the reason that he wasn't in the Hall of Fame is because of that relationship that he had with Philadelphia and Philadelphia media.
Yeah, for sure. Some old media guard made it impossible that he would get in on the writers' ballots. Yeah. It had to be the veterans.
Some real gatekeeping that went on for a myriad reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to some of the new guard, though, even in town. Megan Montemurro, who covers the Cubs for the Tribune, she worked in Philly for forever, and she wrote a couple of different columns saying, why isn't this guy, why isn't he more beloved, and why isn't he in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, and that kind of stuff ended up mattering, as is did eventually they start valuing walks and on-base percentage. Like, he was a big on-base percentage guy, and that mattered. And the shortness of the career.
His on-base percentage for his career was .378.
Outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. One more thing, as you talked about cool, it is because of him and the White Sox organist, Nancy Faust, that walk-up songs were invented. This is a great story.
The walk-up songs was something I always enjoyed at the old yard.
Dick Allen was her favorite player, and when he came up to bat, she would play Jesus Christ Superstar, which is exactly what he was, a superstar.
Credit to Last Comiskey that she invented the walk-up song for Dick Allen. And then
so dope.
It's everywhere, obviously. It's pervasive in all of sports. That's where it got invented, right there. Just awesome.
So congratulations to the Cobra. And congratulations to Dick Allen.
Man, anytime I do a draft of great right field throwing arms, which we do from time to time, maybe not during this baseball hour, because that is, you know, we've done enough. But Dave Parker's name comes up with good reason.
And two guys, like from a personality standpoint, they're very different in their style publicly. Seeing both of them get into the Hall of Fame did my heart real good.
Good man. Stuff. Good
real
stuff.
Real good.
Hope you enjoyed the first ever baseball hour on Spiegel and Holmes.
Yeah, when we come back, something happened last night that Spiegs was kind of excited about.
And then I didn't last very long.
We'll explain what... Wait, we should change that tease.
Oh.
No.
Well, we were talking about a guy named Dick with a mammoth log.
Correct. Right, we were talking about something else that Spiegs was really excited about and then didn't last long with.
What?
We'll talk about that next here on The Score.
Spiegel and Holmes.
Good vibes, baby.
Afternoons on The Score.
So, what do you think of the Lady Crusty mustache removal system now, Angelique?
It's crest-erific, Johnny Unitas. But is my upper lip supposed to bleed like this?
Probably.
Now, Johnny Unitas, there's a haircut you could set your watch to.
Last night, for some reason, Monday Night Football gave you the option of watching, instead of just watching Bengals Cowboys, which in itself was a chore until the end of the game, which was ridiculous, they gave you the option of watching the Simpsons cast.
They did.
Of it.
They really did. And if you've got a son who's 12 and loves animation and doesn't really seem to love watching football with you, it feels like one more last-ditch effort to see if you can hook the boy on something you spend a lot of hours doing on your couch.
Okay, so I didn't realize that that was the context of you and Ruben watching the game last night.
And Christine, all three of us sat down, fired up the old Disney Plus, and turned on this game. First of all, like big-ass corporate media merger lets the Fox characters, the Simpsons, and the Disney ESPN product, Monday Night Football, live in sin together, right?
Yeah.
Took me a minute to wrap my head around that.
I didn't understand, other than like drawing people to the app, what the draw was. And I did think a lot of it was cool, like seeing Mina Kimes as a Simpsons character I thought was dope.
Yeah.
Bart, Lisa, and Ralph are in. Bart Simpson takes the snap, throws
give it to
Ralph. Touchdown!
Ralph!
He's not in danger. He's in the end zone.
Guys, he choose to throw it to Ralph. I'm so happy for the little guy.
Oh, all right. That was kind of adorable. But those like Simpsons puns that were written for and provided to Dan Orlovsky and Mina Kimes on the broadcast, and whoever the play-by-play human was, apologies to the play-by-play human. I don't know who it is. But
Simpson looking to throw, he floats. Play clock down to three. Simpson looking to throw, he floats it toward the end zone. Touch diddly down. C.D. Lamb.
You should know his Drew name. Carter?
Drew Carter.
Drew Carter? All right, good for Drew Carter. It was a little cringy. It was a little cringy at times, Lawrence.
My issue with it is I feel like there are better ways to incorporate the Simpsons into a broadcast other than changing the actual players into Simpsons characters.
They changed the actual players into animated characters, and they had their actual names. I mean, it was kind of amazing that they can do this in real time.
Yes,
it was the behind the quarterback camera angle, and for that was the one that they were able to digitize somehow and turn into animated characters in real time. You're watching real time animated football.
I do think that that's some of this. I do think that there is a whip it out element here from a technological standpoint that you want to do. I was sitting there going, okay, who is this for? Because theoretically, I'm supposed to be who that's for.
Because you're a Simpsons guy?
Yeah. I'm a Simpsons fan, and I love football.
If you had a kid, it would for sure be for you.
Would it?
Well, it was for me.
Was it?
I'm a Simpsons guy.
Was it for him?
We lasted about two drives.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. It didn't look that great technologically. These kids today, they're spoiled. We're watching that, and I'm like, yeah, there's some glitches going on. Like the players were sliding across the digital field after they were tackled. Ruben's like, this looks like a PS1 game.
Hey, Ruben, I'm sorry, but this feels like the Louis C.K. no Wi-Fi on the plane bit. Like, good Lord, this is amazing.
You're sitting in a tube in the sky.
Like, the fact that they can even do this is amazing. Like, the Blackhawks try to do this also, where they'll do, oh, it's Tommy Hawk's birthday party, and then they'll do an animated simulcast of the game. So they're trying to hook the youngsters.
Did it work for Juju?
No, we didn't watch it. No, I took her to the real game, you know? Like a real dad, you know? And she enjoyed that.
Do 12-year-olds even know what The Simpsons... Do they watch The Simpsons?
This is what I'm saying.
Does Ruben watch The Simpsons?
He knows
like,
about
The Nickelodeon
Simpsons.
Game, that works. Because 12-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, they watch Nickelodeon. They know what slime is. They don't know Homer Simpson and the Crow.
Mine's 10, big time into The Simpsons. Thank God.
Okay. Yeah,
daddy's teaching her right in that regard.
Why are you hanging out with studs so much?
That's true, yeah. but I don't know if she would have cared about this. But they have the technology, so they're just trying to, you know, see if the cat licks it up, so to speak.
Throwing it out there, see if the cat licks it up. It did not get licked up at my house. I mean, Ruben might have stuck with it. I was cringing. I was like uncomfortable, and it was forced viewing for the entire family.
And again, you're the target.
I'm prime target. Absolutely.
So I don't know. It just seemed really strange. I actually thought that it may have been more cool to keep kind of doing what they were doing with the ESPN analyst. That Mina Kimes was on NFL Live.
Yeah.
As her Simpsons character.
And she was, and they kept cutting, and she and Orlovsky were, and of course, the great Drew Carter, whose name I'll never forget again.
Spiro Dita.
It was an Andrew Catalan? There's no way to know. I'll take nameless and faceless NFL play-by-play broadcasters for $500, Alex. But yeah, it was, some people seem to enjoy it. So, someone said it was 5 minutes delayed, so it felt like real time, but it wasn't like real time. Okay, I didn't know that. But how about that sick burn from the boy? This is like a PS1 game.
Yeah, that hurts, man. That hurts, Ruben. Damn. As we're sitting there in our office with the classic NES in our office, what must he think of that?
Oh, dude, not much.
He thinks it's Pong.
I should break out the Atari 2600 and see what he thinks about
that. You got to break out Bird versus Magic on Atari and be like, this is what video game basketball used to be. Do, 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 do.
Keep it up, Ruben. You're going to hear that Tecmo injury music real fast.
Real fast.
And you will never come out of the hospital and get back on the field. Oh, no. Ruben with a sick burn about this looking like a PS1 game, and Uncle Lawrence has taken him to the woodshed.
Hey, I told you, the belt.
That seems to be your answer for a lot of things.
That's why I don't have kids. Lance Briggs is going to join us. He is upset about something he saw towards the end of the game. And we are going to tap into... Well, he's upset about everything that he saw with last week's
game. He's also upset about everything at the beginning and in the middle.
But there was something in particular that he did not like. And we are going to tap into that anger next on The Score.